Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 26, 2003. Today's session is Take Me Out to the Ball Game, presented by Thomas Christian and David Wee. WED 2003-09. Let's listen in.
This is the session entitled Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Two of us are going to lead this session together, Thomas Christian and myself, David Wee. And we'll start off by introducing ourselves and then explain a little bit about what we'll do in class. So go ahead.
I'm Thomas Christian. I'm from Port Angeles, Washington. And I'm 13 years old, and I play catcher and outfield.
Are you going to high school?
Quite, cut. Okay,
it's okay. I'm David Wee. I'm an English professor at St. Olaf College in Minnesota, where I've been teaching a course on baseball and American culture for over 25 years now. One of the things that we'll do today, I'll explain a little bit about what we do in a college course on baseball, because people are always wrinkling their foreheads and saying, what do you do in a semester-long course on baseball in college that's done on the classroom and not on the playing field? So I have that perspective. I'm 64 years old and have been interested in baseball for quite a while. So I represent the aging generations here to talk about why it is that people of my age still care about baseball as much as we do. Thomas is a baseball player and comes from another generation, and we'll be glad to talk about the perspective on baseball from his generation. One of the things that I always do in my baseball course, and we'll do it right now, is to have what I call batting practice, to get the class warmed up while the latecomers are coming in. We ask a few trivia questions. And we've put some, and here I direct you to the right-hand column here. These are some numbers. And Thomas and I think that there are many of you out there who know exactly what those numbers represent. And others of you who are baseball widows or widowers, you know, wonder what in the world do these refer to and why does anyone remember them? And that's one of the sorts of things we'll try to get at today is
why does anybody care?
That's right. That's one of the main questions. Yes. This whole crowd will answer that articulately, I'm sure. Since this is on disk, do I have to read these out loud? 2,130. What does that represent, that number?
Lou Gehrig's
record for consecutive games played lasted for years and years until it was broken by
Cal Ripken.
With how many consecutive games?
2,632.
Okay. What's 511?
Cy Young.
Pardon?
Cy Young's wins.
That's right. That's the major league record for the most wins in a career by a pitcher. Cy Young. 511. It also represents something else. Anyone else know where 511 is important? It's Mel Ott's career home run total. I was teaching a class like this once, and nobody in the class knew what 511 represented except a 9-year-old girl. She raised her hand and said exactly what you did. This is Cy Young's record, and everybody's jaw drops. And then another person in the class said, and by the way, that's also the number of career home runs hit by Ernie Banks.
Ooh.
511. The 9-year-old girl's hand went up she said very quietly, politely, Ernie Banks hit 512. Anybody know that one? Getting a little more obscure here. That's the most number of career wins by a left-handed pitcher. Why? Anybody know who that did that?
Warren Spahn.
Good for you. Thank you. Number 215. Anybody know that?
The Mendoza line.
Yep. None of this except
white. What is that?
Yeah, explain the Mendoza line.
Oh, the Mendoza line is like you want to be above hitting 215. That's the batting average. And if you go up to bat twice, you get hit once. That's 500. So if you go up to bat four times, you get hit once. It's 250. So you want to stay above 215.
Why is it called the Mendoza line?
Because what was his first name?
Mario
Mendoza hit. He had like a terrible year that year.
I think it's his whole career.
His whole career.
Oh, okay.
118.
Most wins in a season.
No, 0.18 is that one.
Some pitcher batting average.
Lowest batting average ever by a position player?
No. Yeah, you know what that is, don't you?
No, I don't.
That was my batting average. That's the number of stitches on an official Major League Baseball.
In a day or a season?
Yeah. Permanently. Number 56.
One of the Mangio's games.
Hitting streak.
Hitting streak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Executive games.
406. October 3rd, 1951.
Oh no.
Okay.
Erase that. That was D-Day in Brooklyn.
Okay, explain it.
Thanks to Ralph Franca came in the ninth inning with two outs. And Bobby Thompson hit the home run against the Dodgers, and Giants won the pennant.
Guess who Warren cheered for?
He was there.
116.
The most wins of two years in a season.
Yep, 120.
What was that?
116.
Yeah.
That was the most wins in the season by the 1906 Chicago Cubs and the 2001 Seattle Mariners. 120. Yeah. 120.
Most losses in a season by the 1961 or two Mets.
Yeah. 1.12.
Bob Gibson's ERA in 1968 for the season.
Who's?
1.005. This is the batting average, actually.
What was
112? 112 is
Bob Gibson.
Bob Gibson's ERA. Lowest earned run average in a season by a starting pitcher. 1968. 0.3005. Anybody know that? That's the lowest batting title ever, which means you have the highest batting average in the league. So that's the lowest one. Done by?
Carl Yastrzemski.
Carl Yastrzemski. What year?
67.
68. Good. There we go.
What was the day of Jackie Robinson's first day?
It was April 1947. I don't remember the day of the year, of the month. Yeah. Well, you Those of you who couldn't answer all these, you know, heard there were enough people here who know and remember these to begin to recognize how baseball history and some of its numbers stick with us. Warren, you told me this morning something about numbers and statistics.
Well, I'm getting forgetful. So my numbers, my pen numbers are Campanella, Robinson, Campanella. And then on the one card is Hodges, Campanella, and Ferrello.
They're
so
uniform numbers.
My pen numbers I remember now. I couldn't remember anything else but the Dodgers and numbers.
And one of these numbers up here is my credit card PIN number.
I know.
some of us can remember certain numbers forever, and they all come from baseball, it seems.
Yeah, there's something analogous to the end of life when a person is dying. Often all they can remember is the Lord's Prayer or certain other prayers.
Yeah.
There might be a parallel here.
Yes.
Just
a few other numbers, things that I'll ask you about. What's the weight of a baseball? Just hand the baseball around. It's one of the most beautiful things ever. What's the weight of a baseball? Anybody got a good guess? Or its diameter? Or circumference? You know, we look at these things all the time.
11 3/4 ounces.
How much?
11 3/4.
No.
Only 2 pi.
8 ounces.
Yeah.
Okay.
Standard Major League Baseball is 5 ounces. And its circumference is 9 inches. And then you all remember the stitches now, which is 215. Many of us sitting in the stands at a ball game consider ourselves much more perceptive than the home plate umpire at calling ball and strikes. This never seems to notice when they go across or miss. How wide is home plate?
12 inches.
12, not 12 inches.
17.
17 inches. Well done. Okay. And a base? What are the dimensions of the pillows out there that we call bases? 15 inches. Okay, good. All right. How far are the base paths from one base to another?
90 feet.
And how far from the pitching rubber to home plate?
60 feet.
60 feet, 6 inches. Did that ever change the distance on the bases or not?
They experimented with different distances back in the early years, but what got established very early on at 90 feet. And all, those of us who watch, and you must think of this often, if it were 91 feet or 89 feet, how much the game would change. It's some kind of revelation that they must have had. And what's the longest distance in baseball?
Home plate, second base.
It's from the pitching mound to the showers.
That's
Okay, Thomas is going to ask a few other batting practice questions.
I have just a few trivia questions. My favorite one probably would be name two current players that have represented six different teams in an All-Star game.
Two current players
that represent six different teams in an All-Star game.
Over their career.
Ricky Henderson?
Not the same day.
Current players, not minor leaguers.
Yeah.
Ooh. This went down. Yeah.
Roger Clemens
won. He's played for three teams. The Red Sox, the Blue Jays, and the Yankees. Right now they're both playing for the National League.
Kenny Lofton.
I think you'll have to help us out here.
Roberto Alomar and Kevin Brown.
David, I was listening to Garrison Keillor 2 or 3 weeks ago. He was in Atlanta. What is the farthest distance that a home run baseball traveled?
500 some feet.
No. The guy hit it out of the park. It landed in a railroad car. This was in Atlanta. And it went to Birmingham.
That's great.
Well, just give me another one. Who hit the longest home run without any help from train cars?
Mickey Mantle?
Yeah, I think that was it. Who was the Houston baseball team before they became the Astros?
Colt 45.
Yep.
I'll ask a couple while you think. Please understand that it's not important that anybody know any of the answers to these. The important thing is, for many of us, is that these things happen. And the astonishment that some of us have and the pleasure from learning about them. Who hit into the only all-Cuban triple play?
Was the hitter Cuban?
No, the hitter was Whitey Herzog, who played for Kansas City and since has become a major league manager and general manager and all that. In 1960, playing for the Kansas City, had they been the Athletics at that time?
Yeah.
Against the Washington Senators, who the next year became the Minnesota Twins.
Which Senators? Was it the Twin Senators? Or there were two?
It was the Washington Senators.
There were two different Senators, though.
Oh. Every state has two Senators. Okay. Whitey Herzog hit into a triple play that was fielded by Camilo Pascual, who threw to Juan Vicerto, who threw it to Jose Valdivielso at first base. All three fielders were Cubans.
That was
totally unimportant, but we'll get into a triple play in his last at-bat in the major leagues. Doing the most frustrating thing, triple play, in his last time at bat in the major leagues. You might guess that it was one of those Mets who lost 120 games in a season. It was Joe Pignatano, the catcher. What a way to go out at the end of a career.
When did the Mets have two runners on base?
Only in the last game of the season. And then this one, who hit a home run in his very first time at bat in the major leagues?
There have been quite a few who have
done that by now, maybe 80 or 90. But then in a 23-year career in the major leagues, never hit another home run. Must have been a pitcher. Good guess. This was Hoyt Wilhelm, who was a famous knuckleball pitcher, mainly for the White Sox. Can you imagine starting that way and then never another one? Another?
Yeah. Up to 2001, who was the all-time hit leader for a rookie.
Ichiro.
Yeah.
Up to 2000. It was Shoeless Joe Jackson. And then who was the the American League home run leader, or no, single season home run leader for a second baseman in the American League?
Brett Boone.
Oh yeah, it is. Chicago Cubs, or not the Cubs, but the White Sox. That's all I got.
Okay. Couple more, and then I think you're well warmed up. Who has the best lifetime pitching record against the New York Yankees? Like, best lifetime pitching record against the New York Yankees.
Sandy Koufax.
Okay.
Roger Clemens.
No, not Koufax. It's not Clemens.
Don Drysdale.
No.
He got two.
The answer is Babe Ruth. Yeah.
Oh.
Babe Ruth was one of the best pitchers in the American League for the Boston Red Sox in the 19-teens. And he was wonderful against the Yankees. They figured out how to stop that. They bought him and then put him into a home run hitter, and you know, the rest is history. But that's one that'll usually win you a beer at the bar.
Who was Harry Steinfeld? What was significant about him?
We both have a book with that title. Who was Harry Steinfeld?
Another baseball trivia question.
Yeah.
He played for third base for the 1906 Chicago Cubs, and the shortstop was Tinkers, the second base was Evers, and the first baseman was Chance, and there's a poem about those three guys, and Steinfeld got left out of the poem.
And out of the Hall of Fame, because the other three got into the Hall of Fame together simply because of poetry. I mean, they were good players, but because they were immortalized in a poem, they've been associated ever since.
Do you know the poem? No.
Okay. I think I know. It's called Baseball's Sad Lexicon. These are the saddest of possible words, Tinker to Evers to Chance. Trio of bear cubs, fleeter than birds, Tinker to Evers to Chance. Turning a giant hit into a double, meaning a double play. Pricking our gonfalon bubble. Gonfalon is an archaic word for, they were always breaking the giant's pennant for a pennant. Trio of bear cubs, nothing but trouble, Tinker to Evers to Chance. So that little ditty, written and published by a newspaper reporter in New York, just became famous, immortalized that double play combination, and Harry Steinfeld, poor man, playing third base, got left out, and he's one of the famous trivia questions in baseball. I'll say a few things about the course that I teach at St. Olaf, and I'm not the only person in the country who teaches sports courses in college, becoming a larger and larger field. Baseball is, I think, the most popular of the sports, partly because, you know, it is our national pastime. You can argue about that. But over here on the left, I've listed a number of the subfields in a course on baseball and American culture. And one could teach some other sports in similar ways, but very quickly. Oh, and I'll send around a sheet of paper here. I only made about 15 copies of these for. Okay. And if you'd like to look, you want to send these that way. If you'd like to look at the questions, on this are the kinds of questions that we ask in an academic course on baseball. There's a lot of good literature about baseball, novels, some poetry. Thomas is going to read Casey at the Bat to you a little bit later on. But a lot of good novels about baseball. There aren't a lot of really good novels about hockey and wrestling, as far as I know. But there's a huge body of literature about baseball. There is a baseball book published every day of the year in this country. You know, 400 baseball books every year. And it's just about impossible to keep up. And they aren't all prime literature, but there's a lot of them. Language. One of the things that is fascinating is how many baseball terms have become part of our language. And we have time when we'll talk a little bit about that and see how many baseball idioms you can think of. Religion. This is one of the fascinating things to me because there are so many scary parallels between the way in which most of us approach our religion and the way in which we approach sport. Sometimes it's football, sometimes it's baseball or basketball. But the kind of devotion that we have, the pilgrimages that people make to Wrigley Field and Fenway Park and Cooperstown, New York, almost always using the word pilgrimage, the kind of rituals that we have, the sacred moments, the church calendar and all that, that are parallel, is really quite startling. Economics, when we argue about use of funds within a culture, and we're all, cities are trying to build $500 million stadium with luxury boxes, when the schools and the playgrounds and social services are being underfunded. Economics is a huge element of sport. I find, as you can tell, that baseball and other sports is a wonderful way for us to get at who we are as a nation and who we are as individuals. If we ask the hard questions like why, and why does this sport so important to these various elements. Psychology. I'm always fascinated by why Warren should be so upset that Bobby Thompson hit a home run. And why did he care so much about the Brooklyn Dodgers? Why did I care so much about the Chicago Cubs? Why do you care so much about the Dodgers? Especially you hired mercenaries. You know, they people we don't really know, but they are plucked by the highest bidder, and they represent our city. But why do we care so much? Why do we always show up at the park when they're winning and not show up when they're losing? Why do whole cities go crazy at times like the World Series? Ethics? Do sports teach character? So what kind of character do they teach? Sammy Sosa puts cork in his bat and it gets discovered, and you know, here's one of the good guys, one of the very positive images of our sports culture, and we discover that he's been using an illegal bat. We don't know if he did it just the one time, as he claimed, by mistake, or if this is part of his regular arsenal. History, the way in which this country grew up with baseball as a part of it, is fascinating to many of us. Aesthetics. Baseball is, for many of us, a beautiful game. Some of us walk into a ballpark and just gasp. It takes our breath away to just see the field and then to remember the trajectories that we've seen and so forth. Metaphysics, where you examine what is something made up of and how does it work. Not very often do we think about games and how they're constructed and how they work. The fact that in baseball, the team that's on the offense is not allowed to touch the ball. You know, in most games using a ball, it's the team that's on offense that is trying to control the ball. In baseball, you can't touch it. Well, most games are based on a kind of battlefield plan where you're trying to cross the border of the other party. And in baseball, you trot around the bases and come home. It's a totally different sense of what we do. Statistics. Here we've been looking at statistics. How important are numbers in our fascination with baseball? I don't know how carefully we keep track of the number of shots on goal by the right forward of, you know, the Montreal Canadiens, and, you know, memorize statistics about it. It was similar things with other sports, but with baseball, numbers are huge. Sociology. How have sports and baseball helped minority people move into mainstream economic life of our country? There are some wonderful stories about Jackie Robinson, who became the first black player in the last century to play Major League Baseball, and managed to integrate this sport, which was a totally white male sport, for 7 decades, long before this country could do it with our own schools and restaurants, and all the ways sport somehow sort of broke barriers before this could. And then art, film, music, theater, there are just all sorts of wonderful movies about baseball that some of us see over and over again. One of the recent, was it a Tony Award that went to the best play of the year in New York? It was a baseball movie about gays, a play about gays in baseball. Lots of great music and musicals like Damn Yankees that celebrate baseball. So there's just a whole, you know, of course you can spend weeks on any one of these topics, and it, underneath every discussion is getting at the questions, why baseball, why do we care when we're young, why do we care when we're old about it, and you know, Thomas and I welcome any questions or suggestions that any of you have as ways of helping think about why baseball is so important, and whether it's more important now than some of the other sports that are gaining popularity, like soccer and so forth. Thomas and I were talking, and I was asking him how much attention your generation, you know, your schoolmates and teammates, paid to Major League Baseball. I remember when I was Thomas's age, on any given day, for several years, I knew the batting average of every player in the major leagues. Mm-hmm. Sort of recomputed them in my mind every day. And it's not quite that way with a lot of your friends, is it?
No, it's not. Plus, there's about 8 new teams,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah.
But most of them, almost all my friends that play baseball, they're not really into Major League Baseball and players. I have a few that are. But, and even the ones that, if you ask them, they say they are, they still don't really keep up. Like, one of my best friends the other day, we were talking about who we thought was going to, like, make it to the playoffs. And he was surprised I didn't mention the Angels. And at that time, they were under 400, or under 500. And he just obviously wasn't paying attention to it. And I just kind of see that that's interesting. Because as he said, most his age would know that.
Yeah. Others of you, can you talk about how it is that you came to know and love baseball? Or why it is that you still read the box scores?
Well, for me, it was the game I could play when I was,
yeah,
in sixth grade. It was the sixth grade teams against the other, and it was co-ed. And everybody would move up when I was at bat, but I was the best catcher. I could football, forget it, and basketball, sure. Volleyball, sort of, but this was outside in the sun. Everybody was kind of helping me. It was just fun, and I could do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to be 7 feet tall to be a good baseball player. And you don't have to be 280 pounds to play baseball as you might to play football.
Yeah, and I couldn't afford a bat and a ball, but I found a baseball bat on the beach and scrounged a ball somewhere, and I would go home and I'd hit that off the weeds.
Yeah. Right. It's, it seems to be more accessible to people of more common dimensions than some sports, which require, you know, vast size.
There are variations of the game that I think contribute to that. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in New York City where I didn't play a lot, but I saw a lot of stickball games, which was played really with a cut-off broomstick as the bat and these little pink Spalding balls, and they would play on streets and using the cars as bases. So you didn't need to have a field nearby. It was a different game, but it was also connected enough.
Yeah.
You know, and there's fast pitch softball and slow pitch softball, and
that's right.
It kind of increases the family in that way.
Yeah, good point.
Yes. We used to do wiffle ball. Wiffle ball, and you'd make up the teams. One kid was the Dodgers, and the other kid was the Los Angeles Angels, and you'd play it out as a drama and decide, you know, who was going to get the home run, who was going to pitch. And it was sort of more of a drama than a real sport.
Yeah.
When my father was at the seminary, he said, during the World Series, one professor who was so uptight about everything called off classes during the World Series so they could all listen to the World Series.
I remember the magic of being a 10, 11-year-old boy lying in bed after I was supposed to be asleep listening to my transistor radio under the pillow to the broadcast of the baseball games.
Yeah.
And I found out years later that this was when Seattle only had a AAA minor league team. I found out years later that many of the away games, the announcers weren't really there. They were recreating the games based on the wire service reports, and they had little sound effects for the crack of the bat. And, they had a tape loop of the crowd, and they would raise or lower the volume. But it transported me to another world.
I have the same memory, except I had one of those little crystal radios with a little needle that went on a crystal that drew in the announcer in Chicago. And Mom and Dad didn't know I was up there in the upper bunk listening to ball games.
Just to pick up on that, I wasn't in that era, but my dad, who's actually up here, but I don't think he made it to this class, he has very fond memories in Seattle of that same era, and he says it was amazing. And I don't, some of you will know the announcer's name, but you should describe in great detail, you know, what the pitcher was doing. I mean, it was all fake, but he'd be like, oh, he picks up the rosin bag, and he scratches his nose, and then, you know, whatever. But, I mean, he made up all that stuff, and he was just reading, he was receiving the wire service report, and that's, to me, a fascinating era. I wish that I had heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, well, I'm 79 now, but when I was a kid, sitting on the front porch with my uncle and listening to the Chicago Cubs. I lived in Indianapolis. And it was almost like, they don't get that now, but you could almost like be there at the game the way they brought it out.
Yeah. I'm told that years ago that people in the cities used to be able to walk down the streets through town and hardly miss anything because all the people were out on the front porch listening to the radio.
Yeah.
You know, this is pre-air conditioning. And just hear the whole ball game while you're walking around town through the residential area.
And that that increases your imagination because you can almost like you're there, whereas television, it does nothing for your imagination.
Yeah. Any of you remember how you, when you first saw a baseball game, or
For me, it was when I went to the East Coast to go to graduate school. The first game I ever saw was actually Fenway Park against the Mariners. So I was one of the few people rooting for the Mariners, but it was a magical place to be introduced to baseball, and I think it contributed to my being a real fan.
Yeah.
I was 6 years old and we moved from Chicago to New York and we were going to Yankee Stadium, and I can still smell everything.
Yeah.
The popcorn, the peanuts and everything. My family didn't have a lot of money in those days, and you could go to a doubleheader, I forget what for, but it was really cheap, and you just be there for hour after hour after hour. I mean, it's like the Great Leap of Easter or something.
Yeah.
You just be there for hours.
Yeah.
And you could get up and move around or sit down and have a kind of eternal quality to it. And people who were total strangers would talk to each other. Very community.
The first game that I went to, I remember, was at Wrigley Field with my grandparents. And one of the things I remember about the game is behind home plate, there's always a screen that's up to protect the people that are sitting behind that. But above that, they also had a net. So that foul balls that went back up there would land in the net and then roll down, and the crowd would all go, and back then they used to reuse those balls.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing now how many more balls I think they go through over the course of a game.
Yeah,
but there they
balls throw it up into the crowd.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good trivia question too. Is how the average number of balls in a game used?
Yeah.
I don't know if folks know that answer, but
do you have any idea?
There's like an average I heard from. I think it was even here from somebody that was like. I can't remember if it was every pitch. I don't think it was that. Every batter receives like 1.5 different balls. So
yeah, game average approaches 200 baseballs. I mean, it's a it's a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Well,
and every fan is hoping that one of those foul balls is going to land in our laps and take it home. Why? Why then do these relics matter so much to us? A baseball caught in the stands or autographed by a player, or baseball cards. I collect baseball cards, I collect baseballs, you know, and I have to keep asking myself why, as my brother is asking as well. But why does a little piece of cardboard or a little round ball that you can buy at the store, why do we break our legs, you know, leaping for them in the stands?
I want to ask a question of every middle-aged male here, and that is, how many of us would be multimillionaires if our mothers had not thrown out our baseball
cards?
Mothers know about Jubilee and equalizing the field. I had a recollection of great disillusionment as a child, as a Twins fan, and I guess it speaks to how I took those players into my heart when my dad explained to me that no, Zoilo Versalas and Frank Quillacy, Antonio and Harmon Killebrew hadn't grown up in Minnesota.
Yeah.
They were not hometown boys.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, finding out your relatives weren't related to you.
The loyalty that we have toward the home team and the anger we feel, you know, when Ken Griffey Jr. leaves the team, gets traded away, or Randy Johnson, or Rodriguez. Yeah. But, how much we care that somebody we become attached to because they're on our team leaves and seems to be a crushing blow.
And conversely, the affection we feel for players like Kirby Puckett, who remain with the same team their whole life because that's where they want to be.
I
think some of that came from, I came from a small town in South Dakota where, I was going to say, one of the things that's unique about baseball, when I was a kid, one of the things that astounded me was that our players, the American Legion home team, were people on business people and farmers. And they were people I knew from other, and I was always amazed that these guys would be businessmen, policemen, farmers. and at night they would put on these silly suits and come out and play baseball and act like kids, act like we did during the day. And I think it was it's partly that that makes you object that people that are sold and traded and all this, because it was a hometown thing.
Well, I still remember how surprised and pleased I was when I first came to Holden Village 20 years ago and discovered what the miners did with the one piece of flat ground they made a baseball field of it.
Now let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You think back in the days of the Yankees, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Hank Greenberg, you think the teams then stayed together as a complete team better than they do now? Not as much trading?
Free agency. And I can actually explain a little bit about why free agency happened, because I did a school project on rights and responsibilities, and I chose Curt Flood and his lawsuit against Major League Baseball. And it took place in 1969, and Curt Flood was a black player who was playing for the St. Louis Cardinals at that time. And the Cardinals wanted to trade him to the Philadelphia Phillies, who have a reputation of have fans that are hard on players, and still do. Since he was black, there were a lot of racist fans in Philadelphia. And he believed that he had the right to choose where he wanted to work. And there was a clause written out in baseball that said you can either retire or the baseball team that holds your contract owns you for life. And he thought that was unconstitutional, and he filed a lawsuit and eventually won and brought arbitration to baseball. And he was blackballed from baseball. And it was Dave McNally and Andy Messerschmidt in 1975 who actually brought down all of the reserve clause and brought free agency to baseball. So it started out as a good thing and went bad.
And most of us know about the Black Sox scandal. We heard about it, and Shoeless Joe Jackson and seven others being banned from baseball for life for intentionally losing games in the 1919 World Series. And almost every baseball movie or book somehow works itself into the matters of ethics and cheating and throwing games and so forth. And partly, the cause of it was that Charles Comiskey, who was a cheapskate owner, wouldn't pay these league champion players enough salary, and he had them, he owned them. He had the reserve clause, and the players could not leave. So when the gambler comes and says, I'll give you twice your annual salary if you'll just manage to lose the World Series to the underdogs, it helps us understand why it was extremely tempting to the players and why it was important for the players finally to defeat the reserve clause and be able to sell ourselves to employers whom they wanted to be with.
Now the players are the strongest union in the United States of America.
Yeah. Well, David, you celebrate the training. You celebrated when Andy Tafco came from Brooklyn, right?
Yes.
And I know.
Yeah.
The other thing that you mentioned about the Kirby Puckett, that's a sad scene in Minneapolis. One man was king of the hill in Minneapolis, in Minnesota. And it's so sad now. His name is barely mentioned.
He was inducted into the Baseball's Hall of Fame the year before, and then because of illegal behavior, suddenly he has to lie low.
Yeah.
What happens to fans in places like where the Marlins, where you're world champions, and then it yeah. falls apart?
Yeah. So, good question. The Florida Marlins won the World Series. You know, what year was it?
1997.
1997. And what happened right after that?
They sold the team. They have players such as Kevin Brown, Cliff Floyd. Well, he's on the team, I believe. Gary Sheffield, Benito Skia. And basically, the next year, they just had to dump salary, and they let all these players go or traded them. And now they're playing for other teams. And
yeah.
The Marlins are in last place and playing in a terrible stadium with no fans.
Yeah, that's your question. What do fans do when that?
What do they feel like?
That, yeah, I think they were outraged that they finally had a championship team.
Didn't they sue the team, the fans that had season tickets? I think they sued. I don't know what came out of the suit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure, but devastating to a community. To finally have a team that's the best in its area, in its sport, and then have what seems like an owner who doesn't care and sells off all the good players, and then the fans sometimes stop coming.
I grew up in Minnesota. My mother is 95, and she's old enough to realize that I'm going to give some of my antiques away, and if you want this, she asks friends. But she's got a signed ball by Earl Batty because she went ice fishing with him. And she could give away her mother's antique lamp, but the ball stays here.
There are certain artifacts and relics that we like to have because we were there when such and such happened, or we touched, I touched Willie Mays in March, you know.
Last March?
Yeah, this is last March, in training. I just was walking by and I saw him, I recognized him, and went up and patted him on the shoulder. Everyone wanted to shake my hand. So,
well, I don't know how many of you have been to Safeco Field in Seattle, but that's about the only park in baseball where you can actually go up right next to the bullpen, and they have chain link fences, and you can talk to the players. And I was just there a week ago today for a school field trip, and a couple of my friends and I, we went down there, and we were just saying hi to some of the players, and a couple of them would say hi, and how's the game going? And it's just kind of fun, you know, to say you talked with Jeff Nelson or Shigetoshi Hasegawa.
Yeah. Now, before we're done, and our hour is up in about 5 minutes, we want to hear some baseball poetry.
Oh.
And Thomas is going to read one of America's most famous poems and one of America's favorite poems.
Oh, I had to memorize Casey at the Bat in fifth grade, and I kind of liked the poem. I got interested in it. And my parents got me this book for my birthday or maybe Christmas the next year. So I'll just read it. Casey at the Bat. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score's 4-2, but with one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Bowers did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could get a whack at that, he'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. Then proceeded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a Lulu and the latter was a cape. So upon that stricken multitude where melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and Blake the much despised tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted, and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second, and Flynn a hug at third.
Is that the ball to cover off it right there?
Yeah. Then from 5,000 throats and more, there rose the lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley, it rattled in the dale. It knocked upon the mountain, it recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile upon his face. When, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him when, as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eyes, a sneer curled on Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered ball comes hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. That ain't my style, Casey. Strike one, the umpire said. From the benches black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of a storm wave on a stern and distant shore. Kill him! Kill the umpire! Shouted someone in the stands, and it's likely they'd have killed him if Casey had not raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's vision shone. He stilled the rising tumult and bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew, but Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said strike two. Fraud, cried the mountain thousands, and the echo answered fraud. But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was on. They saw his face grow stern and cold, they saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let the ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip, his teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence, his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville, for mighty Casey has struck out.
It's a fascinating book to look at, too, because it's filled with old-fashioned pictures and artifacts. Well, thank you, Stephanie. That's good.
I'd like to tell you all about a new children's book that's just out.
Okay.
It's called Summerland. And the plot is that this little island has one spot which never rains during baseball season. And all of a sudden, it's starting to rain, and what is wrong? And two kids, the boy, they're both late grade school. The boy is a terrible batter, but the girl is a very good pitcher. And they are sent out to find out why it's raining. Well, they go through all kinds of adventures, and to get from spot to spot, they have to win a baseball game. And they play the oddest teams. In one team, there's a great, big, huge, tall guy with an axe over his shoulder. And another guy who wears a rattlesnake as a necktie. And I had an awful lot of fun identifying, you know, all the
sure.
mythological characters who show up. And I had an awful lot of fun watching the baseball games. It's called Summerland, and I recommend it strongly.
Okay, thank you. And it would be fun to hear, if we had another hour, we could talk about baseball books and movies that we love and that we recommend to each other to read. But on one of those sheets of paper I sent around, there are some books and movies. Oh, didn't I send that around? Oh, I'm sorry. If any of you would like a list of books and movies and such that you, because you want to buy something for your baseball family member, why, here's a list. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Thomas. This was fun. If any of you want to stay afterwards and check each other on all the baseball nicknames and who they are, why, we'd be glad.